Leadership is taking people on a journey where there's a vision, guidance, and purpose.
Good leaders lead with the heart as well as the head.
Leadership means doing the right thing for the right reason, no matter how difficult it might be.
You're listening to Leadership Unwrapped, a podcast where you will hear from people who are living leadership every day.
Listener caution is advised in this episode. In this conversation, we discuss matters such as depression, anxiety, and suicide, all in the context of executive loneliness. Some listeners may find this upsetting. Hi, listeners. We just had a fabulous conversation with Nick Johnson, author of the book Executive Loneliness, which we've been ranting and raving about for the last number of weeks and telling anyone who'd listen to us about it. It's a fabulous book and it's so relatable to what we've heard from speaking with leaders and having just lots of more open conversations around what it's like to be a leader at times.
Yeah, I very much felt at home talking to him. I think he just puts words and exposure on stuff that people are really feeling but don't talk about in terms of leadership and the loneliness, the pressure that can come with the job. And he's just got a searing honesty about him. He's very open about what he shares. I thought it was a great conversation. I really enjoyed it.
And there's lots of conversation within the book and within this recording as well. But it's about your work life, but also your personal life and how they both play into one another.
Yeah.
As well as talking about some of those really tricky and difficult conversations, like the things like the smiling depression, executive loneliness.
Yeah, very tough.
It's very tough. But he does it in such an honest and open way, and also just such a helpful way. Like, he provides lots of insight into, if you are experiencing these things, this is what you can start to do to get yourself back on track.
Yeah, Niamh, and I think the thing about Nick that I'm kind of left very thoughtful after it. I know I'll be thinking about it for a while, but it's very emotionally robust, the work that he's doing and the healing that he's doing and the repairing of relationships that he does. That's really courageous. It's really worth listening to about that, I think. Certainly it's left me reflecting on how I do my work and how I am as a person. And to have that level of sophistication, to be that emotionally robust and connected, is something to strive for in life. So I definitely got a lot from talking to him.
Yeah, it really is exactly that, something to strive for, isn't it? Because I know I say it in the conversation, but it really had me thinking about the level of depth, we'll say, in my interactions and the relationships that I'm forming with people.
Yeah,
because
definitely.
Yeah, there is that conversation we talk about in the workplace. You know, we often kind of just real surface, like, hi, how are you getting on? How was the weekend?
Yeah.
Or, you know, and I don't even think that's just work. I think we do that a lot in our lives as well. And that lends itself, as he says, to these feelings of isolation and loneliness, which can, of course, be problematic. So, it's really left me thinking about that when I'm with people. Am I really, you know, fully present? Am I really engaging with them? Am I really listening to them, to hear them, rather than to do the few pleasantries, as you'd say, before you get down to business, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I think there's something for everyone here, because you don't have to be a leader to gain some really good insights about just yourself and how you feel as you navigate your world. So, definitely worth listening to, I think.
Yeah, brilliant. Enjoy.
Our guest today is Nick Johnson, and Nick is dedicated to raising awareness and eliminating the stigma around the phenomenon of what we're calling executive loneliness. Nick has worked across Asia, Australia, and Europe, and he's represented major international firms, and in so doing has acquired expertise in international general management, sales, and marketing. And he's also been entrusted to serve as the vice chairman of the Nordic Chamber of Commerce in Ho Chi Minh City and the vice chairman of the AmCham Vietnam Direct Selling Committee, positions that demonstrate his ability to lead, but also to add value on a global scale. Nick is highly self-motivated. He enjoys participating in marathons and has done Ironman events. So fair play there, Nick. He's also enthusiastic about supporting his local community. He volunteers and fundraises for the Samaritans of Singapore, a suicide hotline, and he also does frequent community service for a support group for problem drinkers. Nick is in recovery himself, And he is also an International Coaching Federation ICF coach who loves to work with executives and to help them with their career and lifestyle choices. He holds a Bachelor of Communication, Marketing and Advertising and a Master's in Public Relations from Bond University in Australia, where he graduated top of his class. So, Nick, you're really welcome. And we're delighted that you said yes to talking to us. Since I've read your book, and I know Niamh and I have talked about it a lot, but we also have been talking about it to a lot of people that we're working with and teaching, because we think that you are shining a light, or giving a space to talk about something that so many people experience, but maybe never feel okay to talk about. So hopefully our listeners will get to hear your insights today. So you're very welcome.
Thank you so much, Patricia. It's great to be with you on the show, and thank you for talking about this topic, which indeed have so much stigma around it, and indeed mostly likely people are avoiding discussing it at all.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and what I think, and I know, again, Patricia, we've chatted about this, but I suppose what stood out to me the most about it when I was reading through your work, Nick, was everything resonated with what I've heard speaking to leaders, but I never had the same language, I suppose, that you use on some of the topics and some of the feelings, which I think just makes it so much more, it starts to get rid of the taboo around these things straight away, just having language that we can use and identify things like executive loneliness, which we'll obviously dive into a bit more deeply. But I think even having the language starts to reduce that stigma around it.
Yes, absolutely. The more we talk about this, and every time we talk about it, the stigma is indeed being reduced. We sort of normalize the conversation, and it's about being comfortable with the uncomfortable. And that's what we're doing today. So thank you for that.
So, Nick, we usually start people, I know I've done an introduction that's given a sense of where you've come from, but usually we start by asking people to tell us their journey so far, how they've arrived to where they've arrived at. So would you like to give us a brief insight about that?
Absolutely. So I was born in Sweden, educated in Australia, and then I lived and worked the last 20 years in Southeast Asia, mainly in Vietnam, Indonesia, Thailand, and Singapore. So I worked my way up the career ladder, you could say, you know, starting as an account executive, then manager, director, and general manager, and then managing director of large firms. So I seen myself perhaps, you know, following the rat race, elbowing my way to the top. And that's what I did. That's what the society gave me, or, you know, and I was just following what everyone else was doing without really questioning it. But once I reached the top, I realized that indeed it can be quite lonely there. So that's what I'm with you today to talk about, and my experiences, but also the experiences from other leaders who've had similar journeys, and what can we learn from this? And perhaps there's another way.
Yeah. So we would say that's a very cosmopolitan background. You've got a nice breadth of international experience. And you've written this book called Executive Loneliness, which I must say I really enjoyed reading. And you tell a little bit of your story in the beginning of the book, which gives good context for people to understand that what you say is both from experience, but also from the research, because you blend both in your book. So do you want to maybe tell us a little bit about why you're talking about this particular topic, why you're so passionate about it?
Yeah, so what happened was a couple of years ago, things were not going so well for me. I was let go from a job, and I was becoming very defensive about it. I blamed the company and my boss rather than looking at myself. I wasn't perhaps ready at that stage to take a critical look at myself and admit my mistakes in the situation. So it left me full of, you know, anger, sadness, anxiety, and so on. Then I managed to get another job, and I loved that role. It was a similar company. I worked my way up there to managing director, and they promoted me to move to our head office, which was based in Indonesia. And once I relocated over there, the company went through a merger and acquisition, and I was let go again. And that filled me with a lot of anxiety and also a lot of self-doubt. And I wasn't really sure what to tell my parents, tell my friends, to tell other people. And I just couldn't even imagine telling people that, you know, I've been terminated a second time from a job. I felt like a big loser. And what I did then was that I pushed everyone who loved me and who I loved away from me. I pushed my ex-wife away. I said, let me deal with this myself. We had a son together who was 5 years of age at that time, and we had to take him out of the school in Indonesia, and we weren't sure if I would be able to get a new job there. So my ex-wife and him moved back to Sweden where they could put him in a school and so on. And then during that time, I managed to get a new job in Jakarta, Indonesia, but I had so much anxiety inside me. I remember going through the probation period of 3 months, but always thinking, you know, maybe tomorrow I have an email that they, you know, terminated my employment or whatever, and it could happen again. And this continued, and it was so bad in the end that I couldn't cope with the pressure anymore. So I resigned from the job, and that was sort of the beginning of my fall.
And there's quite a lot of trauma with losing a job so quickly and having to move and change that we don't acknowledge in the career journey. It's just move on to the next thing. But I certainly hear in the way that you talk about it, and from those that are very close to me who experienced it, there's a trauma that stays with you when that happens. Is that your experience too?
Yes, absolutely. Because so many of us define ourselves perhaps in our job, when we introduce ourselves, you know, it's what do you do, you know, and we answer perhaps with the company we work for, or our profession, I'm an accountant, you know, rather than saying, you know, what do we do for a living? Well, I live for swimming or yoga, or I read books or whatever. We first tend to title ourselves in a profession or so on, and we group ourselves there. So that's the issue with this. And when that is pulled away from you many times, without any notice, you're just suddenly called into an office and you let go. And then your whole world is just upside down immediately. And it's really hard to be prepared for that. And we will discuss today perhaps how you can prepare for it. But I was not ready. And it certainly created a lot of turmoil in my life. And I know that many people are being let go these days. Yeah. So I'm hopeful that this conversation will help them.
Yeah. And I was really struck in the book when you talked about the anxiety in the next job, you know, the constantly waiting for the email, and the not being sure and not feeling that it was, you know, whether you were doing it the job the way that it was expected, or all of those questions that you were asking of yourself that affected your capacity to enjoy the job, the new job, which was really striking to think that you carry it with you. It's not just it happens, it's over, you get the new one, but actually you carry it with you and you carry the anxiety into the next job.
Yes, and looking back at it, and also discussing with the colleagues and friends I had in the company, I was doing really well in 95% of my role. There was one part of the job which I didn't do so well in, and that was in regards to work that required numbers, spreadsheets, and so on. And I didn't have the confidence at the time to stand up and tell my boss, you know, that I need help with this. I was trying to hide it, and I'm working extra hours trying to make it happen, but then it was full of errors, and I was trying to covering up for the errors instead of being open and honest. It all would have been much better if I would have done what I would have done today, which would have been admit it, I'm not so good at this, can I get some support? And I'm sure the company would have given me the support I needed.
Yeah. I guess that's just easier said than done when you're, you know, in the rat race that you talk about, mm-hmm. you know, when you feel you're trying to get to the next step and prove that you're, you know, you can do everything and you can be everything that the company needs you to be. And I suppose that identity piece that you're talking about, and where, you know, we introduce ourselves and say, I'm Niamh and I do whatever. I suppose it's probably even more so the case when it's someone who's getting up those ladders in an organization, you know, someone that's really ambitious in their work, it's really likely that they're going to have more of that enmeshed kind of a view of who they are as a person versus what their occupation is and how their identity forms because of all of that as well. So you can see how it would happen. I'm wondering, Nick, if you could tell us a little bit, because we've mentioned this idea of executive loneliness in your book and the topic a few times. Would you like to tell us a little bit about, not that we've read the whole thing over and back, but would you like to tell us a little bit about what you mean when you say executive loneliness for our listeners?
Yes. So I didn't realize when I was going through it, and I couldn't really label what I was going through. I think I couldn't really even understand what was happening to me, but I certainly dragged the behavior also with me outside of the workplace. Because I was anxious and worried inside work, I also was questioning everything about myself and my relationships outside of work. And that isolation is something that I wanted to look in further. And what I found was that when later on I wrote my book, when I interviewed people, I was not alone. In fact, I found that about 30% of the people I surveyed had had feelings of isolation and feeling lonely in the job. And I want to highlight here that I wanted to look across the organization. You already heard the term, it's lonely at the top, but that might mean for the CEO or, but what I mean with executive loneliness is that it can be lonely anywhere in an organization. And that is certainly the case that I found.
Yeah, that's really interesting point, because I think a lot of the time when we think about loneliness within the organization, it is that phrase, isn't it, that it's lonely at the top. And it's a very good point that you need to think about, right? What if it's lonely at the top, what is it like for everyone else within that organization as well?
Yeah, I was really struck in the book. You talked about, you said, at least in middle management, you can go for lunch or go for a coffee break with the people you work with and share what's going on in your life. But it's more difficult when you're at the more senior stages. And you talk about this gap that actually doesn't allow you the same capacity to have the emotional support that the middle leadership has when you're at the senior leadership. I was really struck by that.
Yeah, because if you are the CEO, there won't be another CEO in the organization. You're probably sitting on a lot of confidential items that you just cannot share with people, and you have no one else who are going through what you're going through. But of course, if you're head of a department and there's 15 departments in the company, you have 14 other colleagues at the similar level who you can have a lunch with, at least, who might be going through something, and you can share best practice and so on. So what I found then is that everyone who is at the CEO position, or if you are in those roles, you need to build up your professional network outside your organization. So if you are a CEO, you need to belong to a CEO group, a mastermind group, or whatever it will be, where you then can have these conversations in a confidential manner, because we all need to vent, we all need to discuss our challenges. And that was not what I was doing. I was keeping everything to myself, to the point where I didn't even want to discuss it with my ex-wife, and instead I pushed her away. And I'm not the only one who's done that. Many people, when they lose their work or they're going through challenges at the workplace, they also find themselves in a divorce, which is sadly what happened in my case.
Yeah, I think because we retreat inwards and we try and figure it out, we sort of think the solution is within ourselves. So we go in rather than actually reaching out. And that's it's really devastating for us in the long term. It follows us, I think. And you know, you talked about the example. I was really struck. I know you've researched with people, but you gave this lady the name Maureen, and she talks about when she asked for help, when she let go of needing to be the one who was seen to fix everything, and then she began to ask for help. So many things changed. She was happier. People were happier at work. You use the phrase, it humanized her in the eyes of other people. And the team began to talk more openly and go above and beyond what they would have done before that by simply opening up and opening up the space to ask for help or to give people the opportunity to come forward. So I was very, very taken with that. I think that's really useful insight for the book to give.
Yes, absolutely. And the latest from her is that she's actually taken a sabbatical year leave from her company now and really questioning herself, educating herself, and taking some time off, because she also, just like me, had just been following the rat race, and Maureen had worked her way up to managing director of a bank, a big international bank. So she's, here's a woman in the man's world.
Yeah.
You know, she's, and if you look on the outside, everyone would think that she has everything that anyone would dream of in this world where we look up at success. She had all the perks, apartments, nannies, international schools for the kids and so on. But she wasn't happy. Something was missing. And it was this missing piece, the connections and the authenticity in her relationships. And just like in my case, the fact that she had issues in the workplace, she also started having issues at home with her husband in the relationship. But once she managed to sort out the part that was missing, then the connection in the workplace, and address this, now she has a flourishing relationship also at home and with her friends and everyone else. So it can change, and it can change very quickly. That is the beautiful thing with this.
Yeah, I think that's very important for us all to remember. And for me in my own life, when things have been really tough, one of the pieces of advice that my mom gave to me was, this will pass. It doesn't stay forever. You just have to take some action to change it or to move it in a different direction, but never feel stuck. Things can move, things can change. And I think it's great. I think you're saying the same thing. I think it's really good advice to give to people.
Yeah, so you're as wise as my mom, Nick. So that's definitely a compliment. Anyway, but I am very interested. You've certainly sparked an area that I want to look at more, and that's the gap for the senior leader and the middle leadership. It's that lonely space, that in between space that you can reach into in some ways, but not always. And how we support leaders to manage that space is really important. And you're in some of the solutions that you put forward, networking is one of the chapters in the book that I think is really important for that. And we've been talking a little bit about networking with other colleagues as well. But it's that social cohesion, that connectedness keeps us alive and keeps us well and keeps us safe. And you're saying that because you give examples of loss of people that's been devastating. So that network is really important.
Yeah, and I think building real relationship is important. There's in every town around the world, there will be full schedule of networking events every day, but most of it might be quite edgy where we don't have meaningful, deep conversations. And I'm in favor of having perhaps smaller, more exclusive events where we go a bit slower, we discuss more deeply and trying to match with people from perhaps similar jobs, similar age, similar demographics, so that we get that connection, so that we can understand each other, and also to have someone who can facilitate it, because naturally even if we are an extrovert, we might not open up and share what is really on our mind or what is really our challenge. It's easy to talk about anything from the weather, as I'm sure you do a lot of sport.
Yeah, or talk about
sport and all these topics. Yeah. What do you get from that? Nothing. You don't really get a deep connection. We get a deep connection when we speak about something that really is meaningful, perhaps an issue you have with your teenage son or something, and you can share about that. And then the other parents can share from their knowledge, then you have a meaningful connection. You leave this event with something, that some takeaways that you can make a change right away. That is what I'm in favor of.
Yeah. And the other thing I think it might help with, and I know I could relate to this actually very much. You said in the book when you got to the next job and you said, although I was constantly being told that I was doing really well, I didn't feel it inside me and I felt scared and I felt anxious. And I think having a safe space to have that conversation outside of, and just not in the echo chamber of your head, would help us move into this. I am doing well and I need to be able to feel comfortable in that. But if it's just rattling around in our heads, we're not able to resolve that. And that leads us into a difficult space as well. But the network or the safe person to talk to, who knows the field and who isn't in your job, who isn't in your organization, but knows the field and is in a similar one, can help us, I think, process and move into positive thinking about the work. That's what I was thinking.
Yes, I agree. And I was given like a mentor in that role, someone who was more senior, but also that person was sort of in my reporting line. So when I had conversations, the last thing I wanted to do was to admit any mistakes or worries to him. I try to impress him so that he would share a positive story. Yeah, Nick is doing well, he's on track, you know, and whenever he would look out for me when there was potentially some promotions or new exciting roles, that was what was on back on my mind. But what I should have done, or at least I do this these days now as a leader of my organization, encouraging everyone to have mentors and coaches, but not the inside organization. We might need them as well, but having external where we dare to be honest and open and share the real challenges and the feelings that we are going around with. If I would have had that during that time, I'm sure that already after the first session, the coach would have recommended me to have an honest and open conversation and admit the things that I was challenged with to my boss, and the boss would have come up with some solutions and all would have been fine. But I couldn't find that. Just like you say, Patricia, just going in circles, the problem in your own mind, the solution is too simple for us to find by ourselves.
Yeah. And I think the outside the organization is something I've said from the very beginning, because there's so many different cultural things happening. And certainly you are working with these people and they may be your leader. They may be, you don't always feel that it's okay to be vulnerable in that space, but you do need to have a safe space to do it. So outside for coaching is, for me, I would think a prerequisite. It's what I, And you mentioned the same thing. You can have a mentor inside and outside. That's fine. You can have two. You can have more than two, but certainly that you have an objective one in there that you can really be. You use the phrase, I keep rigorous honesty, that you can really get into that space. I think that I liked that. Can you tell us a little bit about what you mean by rigorous honesty in the book? Because I really liked, and just throw in the bits that I liked, which were, you talk about when you are radically self-honest with yourself, it frees you to live your truth. It frees you to be yourself when you are not hiding even from yourself, which I really loved. And then you talk about, but I think you like fitness anyway, but you talk about honesty, developing is like building up your muscles. The more you do it, the more honest that you become with yourself and with others. Loved those two. Yeah. Do you want to say what's going on in your mind when you were writing those pieces?
Yeah, definitely. Because as part of my recovery journey, it was about cleaning up the past, you know, things perhaps I said to people, wrongs I done, I had to make amends for them, apologize for them, and really clean all that baggage so I should be able to be free moving forward. But what I'm doing now on a day-to-day basis, and part of every recovery program, would be to do basically an inventory list daily and take stock, where we sort of go back over the day before we go to bed and think about the emails we sent, the messages. Did I say something to someone or send a message that perhaps was not quite nice? Then we need to go back and make amends for them before we go to bed. So that's the next step here. But ultimately, and that's what I'm trying to practice now, to catch myself right away. If I send that email now or a message now, I should already immediately be able to correct it and say sorry for what I just did. And that is the level of honesty that we want, and being that kind of person, because then you can walk around freely. You don't have to remember what did I tell that person, because we're always telling the truth. It's a much easier way of living.
And
if we're stepping on someone's toes and we say something, that if we take it back right away and say sorry, that didn't come out quite right, people will forgive us and they will not hold it too much against us. It's just showing that we are human, and it's all about here about progress rather than perfection. We are not claiming that we are a perfect human being.
Yeah, courageous to do it, to say, you know, actually, I've just looked at that and that isn't the right tone, or I think I was a bit too businesslike there and I missed the big picture. It's courageous to do it, but it's so important, I think. I'm really taken with that.
Yeah, and often we are multitasking today, because we might be in one conversation in a chat group, then we are on a Zoom call, and then the email, and it's all happening at the same time. So it is likely that we are trying to multitask, and then we say something and it comes out short or comes out wrong. We click send before, but we can come back to that 1 or 2 hours later and just call up that person and say, sorry, I rushed that, I was multitasking, I should not have done that, what I meant was this. And then we clear it. For the other person's sake, yes, but more for ourselves, because that's what's going to make you wake up at 3 a.m. in the middle of the night, yeah, otherwise, and worrying about that. So we must clear it.
Yeah, because I think there's a few things coming together. There is the honesty piece, but when I was reading it, I had made note, I was thinking, or there's the self-awareness of it as well, in saying, right, being aware that the actions that you're doing could be having this potential impact. And then there's also the emotional intelligence of it as well, because in that reflection that you're doing, there's probably a sense of that person doesn't like when we interact in this way, for example, whereas another person might take no notice of it. So I think there's a piece about being honest with yourself, but also being aware of your relationship with that person, how that other person likes to work, and responding in an appropriate way. But what I love that you say about it is, like, no matter how many good intentions we have and how aware we are in this space, of course, the busyness of the day is going to lend us to making some mistakes here or there, because we can get all wrapped up in the work that we're doing rather than the person that we're talking to. And I just love highlighting the fact that it's never too late to come back and say, oh, I'm really sorry, I know I sent that quick email earlier, but this is what I really meant to say. And I think that's really important. It's not if you made the mistake, it's not you're a bad person, you don't have emotional intelligence, you're not honest, you know, you don't have self, like, all of these things. It's just that can happen and you can come back and rectify it.
Yeah, for sure. And I think people appreciate, it's a type of leadership that it is authentic, that is genuine. And I think people appreciate it more. They feel safer if they know that you are thinking and that if you make a mistake, you'll go back and fix it. I think that creates trust, and trust is hard won, I feel, in the world of work. And you break it quickly, but it takes a very long time to get it back, if ever at all. So this kind of behavior is really important, you know. Can I ask you a little bit, because you talk about something that's really struck me, Nick. You explain it, you talk about functioning depression, and then you talk about smiling depression.
That's literally the page of the book I had open here to say next.
There you go. But I'm very struck by it. So could I ask you maybe why you thought this was important?
Yeah, I think many people live double lives, perhaps putting on a show or hiding behind a facade, however we want to put it, especially if you are a senior executive, because you're expected to behave and look and feel in a specific way, and everyone is trying to portray that and be like that, even if that's not the natural being they are. And to then put on that show can be very, very challenging, especially if you are an introvert like myself. I don't like to go into a networking event with 500 strangers. I would instantly look for someone I know at the table, and I will run over to the comfort and safety of them. I'm sure I see you nodding, yeah, Patricia.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So to then put on that mask and continue to play what is expected, or the boss pushing you to do things that you're constantly not feeling right about, but you have to do it as part of the job description, then that can be very tiring, because it's then a mismatch between your values and who you are as a person, but who you're expected to be. And that takes a toll. And in my case, in order to do that, I didn't have anyone to talk about this. I just absorbed it, but I had to deal with emotions somehow. And my way to deal with it was alcohol. And many times people pick up bad habits because of this. It can be gambling, social media, sex, shopping, or drugs or alcohol or anything. All these addictions that lie around the corner, because a bad habit can quickly turn into addiction. And then we learn that, okay, well, if I have alcohol, when I have these emotions, it dampens it and I feel better about it. But of course, that only works in the short term. And then when you're coming back to the office the next day, it's 10 times worse. And that's what happened in my case. And while it started to creep in just slowly, slowly, basically because I was already exercising at the time here, and I'm going back to around 2015 when there was turmoil in my office and I started to go through a divorce, then I start skipping some of my gym classes. I stopped not cycling so much. Then I replaced that instead of going to the bar, and my healthy diet fell off. I started to eat fast food. I quickly gained about 30 kilograms, and people around me said, Nick, you look like you're having a good time and healthy. It's good that you're not working out so much. It's good to see you in the bar. You're enjoying yourself, you know, and that was, everyone was cheering on me. But behind the scene, this was basically me losing everything. And step by step, I was falling apart.
That must have been very isolating and incredibly lonely, you know, and the message from other people is completely in the wrong direction. They think it's that you're doing really well. That's an incredibly lonely place to be.
Yes, because they've been wondering, you know, why if I ever would come to the bar before, I would stay for half an hour and leave. Now I could stay longer, you know, and I was more fun and so on. But that was not really me. This was, again, not the natural me. It was because I was not well. I tried to find ways to cope with it. And perhaps it was that temporary comfort of alcohol plus going to the bar and meeting some and become a regular at this place. And it took me a few years to break away from that. And I had to go quite low. I had to hit my own rock bottom, and before I realized that I just have to change.
Yeah. And you talk about this concept of smiling depression. So that's, and you say that it's where you work hard to hide your pain, you know, the fake it till you make it, but the smiling facade. So people, you know, with functional depression, people will see it and people might go quieter. They might withdraw more. So there is a sense that something is going on. But with this kind of, when the outward facade is so fun and so capable, the gap is wider. It's much harder to get help. And fewer people will be reaching in to give you help because they're not seeing it.
Yes, and I found that this was the case for many, many people. And also, as I wrote in my book, in a dedicated the book and the money is raised also to a charity of the SOS, the suicide hotline in Singapore and so on. And it was because a friend of mine sadly died of suicide, someone who certainly was hiding behind a smiling depression. He had, Simon was his name, he was just been to Mount Everest, which was one of his dreams to climb up the base camp there. Wow. He had a girlfriend he loved, he had made positive posts on social media. I was personally following his journey to Mount Everest and so on, cheering on him. And suddenly he was gone. And we were all wondering what happened. And I spoke to his family back in the UK and they also were puzzled. No one knew anything. He managed to put on this show so beautifully great that no one was knocking his door asking that there was something wrong with him. So that's one example of how bad things can go when someone is hiding behind a smiling depression, because we have no idea.
I'm so sorry about the loss of your friend. Mm-hmm. and was really moved by it, having lost a friend to suicide myself without expecting it at all, and thinking that they were coping really well with an issue that was in their lives. But and then it's such a shock, but it's impressive that you're turning something good from this to help other people, so that Simon's experience will actually create some good for others. And that's very moving. The other reflection I have when you write about him, and just when you've talked about him there, is how much energy he must have spent in putting out this so successful, happy, how hard and tiring it must have been. And to be carrying that deep inside them is just, it's heartbreaking. You know, I think that's why I think your work is really important. And I was teaching in Norway last week and I shared your book with everyone. And look what I'm reading. And I handed it around the class and people were looking at it. And there was a lot of school leaders who could really relate to the things that you were saying, which I thought was important to just put the message out about the gap between being a leader and your middle leadership, that you say it's lonely at the top. You can't always talk about issues and people don't necessarily understand you or your position. It's hard, even a risk even, to be vulnerable or to talk about what you need to talk about. And they could really relate to the smiling depression, the having to be seen to be really successful on the outside, and inside in them something else was happening. So it's really important work.
Yeah, thank you. And indeed, it can be extremely tiring to put on that show. And the only solution to it, and I'm discussing that in my book as well, and I keep trying to live it every day. The only way to do this is to be proactive about it, to really, really mm-hmm. build up these relationships in the good times, so that we have some people who we are vulnerable with on a day-to-day basis. So even if there's a signal or we're going down that path of disconnecting and not feeling great, that will be uncovered right away. And there's many ways to do that, and including having a coach, a mentor, belong to a mastermind group, a peer group, or a men's group, or a woman leaders group, whatever it is, these safe spaces where we discuss it, where we have this conversation, and where we are checking in with each other more than just knocking a door in the office on someone. How are you? Did you have a good weekend? That's not the level of honesty we're talking mm-hmm. about. We are talking about, the rigorous honesty here. Yeah. Really, really saying what's on your mind.
Yeah. That's what stood out to me kind of above all else, I suppose, that idea of loneliness or disconnection. And I know you have five steps to recovery or working around this, but I suppose connection and the relationships piece is what I kept coming back to. And like, I know what we've spoken about there, you know, looking for a mentor or a coach or a group to be part of. And I think it's very important for the reasons that you've highlighted, as in that you can be very honest with you know, you don't have the pressures that if it was within your own organization, we'll say, you can be much more honest about some of the challenges that you're facing. But there's also the positives of that as well, where it's not the echo chamber of your organization. You can learn lots from one another in that situation too. Like even in my own interviews, I was researching distributed leadership for my PhD. And I remember one of the participants, their school principal, said, wouldn't it just be fantastic if we could have all of your, you know, participants, everyone who was interested and wanted to talk about this area, all together in one room and see if we could learn from each other's practices. So, you know, there's that piece as well. But to come back to within the organization, something that really stood out to me was that idea that when we're in the work and we're working with our when we're in their workplace, sorry, and we're working with our colleagues, we often don't go into that deeper level of conversation. It is the how are you, how was your weekend, how's whatever, and that alone is conducive to creating that sense of loneliness. And it really got me thinking about the interactions that I was having with people. And now obviously there's things that need to get done in the day. Of course, I'm not saying that every interaction needs to be like that, but it really got me thinking about the interactions I was having with people at work. And to what point is it just that small chit chat, and how much is it getting to know people, getting to know their work, what they're interested in, what they love? That really resonated with me from the book.
It's great.
Yeah.
Another piece for me that was really interesting is about you link to being that exercise and nutrition is really important as a recovery, but also as a way of being healthy at work. And just a little story that I was talking to a leader recently, and she received a diagnosis from her GP that she's been ill for a long time. And he said to her, oh, you must have felt terrible and you must have felt pain. And she said, I don't feel anything. And she realized that she was so disconnected because she was working so much and everything, that she actually was disconnected from her physical self. And that it's her recovery is about actually exercise and nutrition, but actually coming back to listening to her body and what it's saying to her, pain in my head or a pain in my stomach or a pain in my feet. That she had literally, then the doctor was just looking at her going, how? And she said, it's stress, it's work. That was frightening when she, and I immediately thought of you and I thought of your book and I said, you have to read this book because Nick is saying something quite similar. And I think it's the one thing, you know, we've looked at stress in students a few years ago with a great colleague of mine, Dr. Christine Deasy. She was fantastic, but she looked at stress in students and the thing that came across was the poor coping behaviors, that we cope badly. We have all of these, what we call maladaptive, eat too much or eat the wrong foods or, you know, go to alcohol or go to drugs or stop. The one thing that keeps you healthy, exercise, is the first thing you stop when you get into this space. So I think exercise is still very important in your thinking. Am I right in understanding that?
Absolutely. So when I hit my rock bottom back in 2018, then I had a V-shaped recovery, and I'm blessed for that. And it started all by me sharing my story with who is now my new wife. And the first thing she did, she took me to a doctor and right away and shared my story to the doctor. And of course, the doctor gave me medication, which helped me at the time. That is now over 5 years ago, and I've not had alcohol since then, since that doctor's visit, and I changed my life right away from there on. Also starting to get back into exercise just by walking was the first thing I did. But I took the medication because I had so much anxiety and I was in a deep depression and so on. So I needed that. But after a few weeks, I felt that, you know, now I'm becoming addicted to these medicines. If I forget it to take it, then I was becoming really, really stressed and irritated and anxious again. So I said, oh dear, now I just replaced my alcohol addiction with medication addiction, which is also very, very common. But I wanted to be real healing here. I wanted real healing. I wanted to be naturally well. And so I signed up with a coach who gave me then all these wearable devices and he gave me a training plan, and I started to exercise. And my target was to spend 3 months exercising to taper off all the medications. And I managed to do that. So after about 3 months, I was off all the medication, the antidepressant and everything else. And it's now 5 years I haven't taken any of those medication. But I'm keeping up with exercise. I keep up with it. Even if it's walking, that's also exercise. But I mix it. I do not so much of my exercise is intensity. I do a lot of volume, but it's swimming, walking, running and cycling. Most of it is probably cycling and swimming. Yeah. And I find that sort of my meditation, yoga, breathing and everything and all of that. Plus, I'm socializing and meeting a lot of people. Yeah. So I call this the natural happy pill in my book. And that, I think, is a good summary of what it is.
Yeah, you sound like a very strong person when you talk. Do people say that to you?
They do, but I sort of commit to things and then I do it, and I'm quite disciplined in my ways. Once I'm on track, I manage to deliver and so on. But yeah, once I was off the track, then things get really bad.
Yeah. And I love the happy pill. I love that it's very natural and that it's a healing that's very much about the core of your body and your spirit. And I think I love that. I think this is the way forward, actually, is to come back to our human selves and to reconnect with ourselves and with others.
Yeah, and in whatever way suits you too, isn't it? Because I find sometimes when we talk about things like, and I really enjoy sports. I really enjoy exercise. So I would have a passion of that as well. But not everyone does to the same extent, or people have passions about different types of exercise or different types of wellness practices, I'll call them. So I suppose I'm always conscious when we talk about these things, it's not that it's going to be a one size fits all. Do you know that if you do this every week or whatever, that you're going to be looking after your body and your mind? I think there's a part of that journey that's finding what is the physical activity or the wellness activity, I'll call it, that suits you and makes you feel good and makes you feel healthy and gets you on track, that you want to get up in the morning and go and do it, instead of saying, like, I've tried running, so I'm brutal at running. I hate it. I really do. Like when I was the fittest I ever was, I just hated it. And then over lockdown, because it was one of the only things I could do, I started trying to do it again. And I was like peeling myself up off the couch to go do it. I was like, I would rather do anything than do this now. And I was living with a girl at the time and she was like, but you not feel good after you do it? I was like, no, I feel terrible because I hated it. Like, I'm like, why did I do that to myself? And it's just, now people do tell me if I gave it a better go that I'd, you know, that I'd build it up and, you know, you'd get to that sweet spot and things. But the point is, I suppose there's lots of other types of exercises that I would jump up off the couch to go and do because I really enjoy them and I really want to do them. So there's an element of taking that journey to find what it is that you enjoy more so than forcing yourself down the route that you don't, you know.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, and you'll stop doing it if you don't love it. You know, you'll do it for a while, but it has to be the one you love, like swimming or the walking and the cycling that you describe, Nick, I think is really important. But Nick, you also speak my language big time because you say recharge yourself by reading books. And I am so happy that you talk about that. So I think we don't read enough and we're in an echo chamber sometimes. So
yeah, I think it's very important that we sort of switch off our social media, perhaps notifications, put away the phone 1 or 2 hours before bedtime. And if we feel restless, then pick up a book and read before you go to bed, for example, just to clear your mind from all those notifications and things that are following us the whole day. I think that's so important. And that's why, again, it also links back to exercise. When I swim, there's no way I can look at any of the media. Mm-hmm. And when I cycle and run or walk, also I make sure I put it away unless I'm listening to an audiobook or something. So we can also integrate these hours during our day when we get a detox from all these social media and the noise and everything that disturbs us. And reading books is a fantastic way. It's part of in the recovery journey I've been. We share a lot of suggested books and so on, and also in my organization where we at EGM we have peer groups, we have a book club, a group where people are just sharing, you know, which is the latest book they read and why they recommend it and so on. And I think everyone can sign up to some of these book clubs. There's plenty online, they don't cost money, and it's a good way to clear your mind.
Yeah, and I think the audiobooks are also great, you know, if you're driving and you just want to just listen to something good instead of listening to the news, where I know we do need to hear the news, but if it's constantly the negativity that floods in. But if you have an audiobook, for example, you're still reading, but you're doing it in a different way. You're doing it through your ears, which is wonderful. So, and in lockdown in Ireland, the libraries created this borrow box where you could get the audiobooks from the library. And I think that's available to so many people. Fantastic thing to do, just to come out of your head and let somebody else carry you into theirs for a little while. I think it's a great thing to do.
Absolutely. And also the news, I don't watch the news since you mentioned that, Patricia. I think since the pandemic I switched off and I made sure I blocked all news channels on my social media, and I don't have the TV cable plugged in. I can just watch movies if I want to on TV, but I don't have the news channels. They are definitely disconnected for me, and I don't miss much. I'm sure sometimes I just admit that I don't know, but sometimes you might feel a bit, you know, that ignorant, that if there was an earthquake somewhere, you're supposed to know about it. But actually, if it is a major event, then you will hear about it anyway. So I think it's better to disconnect for our own well-being than being completely plugged in and traumatized by all the bad news. We can never take all the world's bad news on our shoulder. We are not born for that.
Yeah. And I also feel the same. I limit, I'm very careful about my TV, but I also limit my news exposure. I feel I can look for something if I need to know about it. And that's what I do. If I hear something and I think, yes, I look for that. Or it'll just pass my radar and I look for that. But I don't really, like, I feel I get lower in myself when I constantly have a news feed coming in. It just makes you, because the bias is so negative in the way that we have, in what we produce as news. So I'm in the same place as you on this one, I think.
And there's also that piece about just the noise that you said, Nick, blocking out some of the noise that's there. You know, when it's constant, you just aren't clear to think about the things you're thinking about or do the things you're doing, or, you know, just without that negativity coming, or just an expectation, you know, I suppose that comes with social media and things as well. So I like that you said that about the noise that comes from it. I'm wondering if we can chat a little bit about, because you have 5 steps in the book about overcoming executive loneliness. So they're taking stock, asking for help, getting healthy, nurturing healthy relationships, and finding your purpose. I'm wondering if you chat to us a little bit about them, Nick.
Yeah, we touched on them, but let's go through it, and I can tell you why I developed them. Because once the book was out, or I was working on the book, I should say, I gave a lot of keynotes, and especially during the pandemic, isolation was a big topic. So I gave keynotes, a lot of all hands meetings on Zoom and so on to companies around the world. And as I shared my story, everyone asked one question at the end. All the events, they asked the same question. They said, Nick, it's great that you came into a recovery program, a 12-step program, and that really seemed to help you. It almost sounds like a blessing that you had an alcohol problem, so you got the support. What about me if I don't have an alcohol problem? How can I get this help? And as this question came up and up and up, I thought, well, let me summarize the 12 steps from a recovery program by removing then the alcohol and some of the other items there. And then these are the 5 steps that are left there. So that's the reason why they are included in the book and why I developed them. Because as I kept answering that question every time. So are you happy to talk you through a summary then for those perhaps who have not been in a 12-step program, then they might find this useful.
Amazing. That'd be fantastic. Yeah. It's so nice to hear the reasoning behind it as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, great. So the first step then is taking stock. And when you come into any recovery program, there will be people who've gone through the steps before, and you will be given a sponsor, for example, who will help you through the steps then. And one of the first things they will do is then to help you and ask you to take stock. What that means then is that you get either a pen and paper or a spreadsheet where you will do a stock take of yourself. And the way it goes is basically, if you think about someone who is a shop owner, you have a store, then you would do an audit. You would do stock counts once a quarter, every day, or once a year, where you look at that. But how often do we take an honest look at ourselves? Yeah. That is what we do here. It's about looking at, what are the issues with me now? And, you know, you might be shocked asking yourself that, but we need to do that. And that's what we do there. So in my case, I had gained 30 kilos, I had an alcohol addiction, I had many people I loved I pushed away from me, I had broken relationships, there were things I said that I shouldn't have said, there was things that were overdue, I had credit card bills overdue, there was a lot of things that it was a mess. So it can be overwhelming to write this down, but that's why in the program I did it with a sponsor. You can do it with a coach or a friend or someone, but just to get that all down on pen and paper or a spreadsheet, and that might take a week or 2 weeks and be overwhelming, but it's like you're offloading yourself.
Yeah.
I love that you're saying that it could take a week or 2 weeks. It's not that you have to sit down in 10 minutes and write it. You know, it's all about giving yours. If you're doing this and you're giving the time to it, it's about giving the time to it, isn't it? And doing it meaningfully.
Yeah. And you said taking stock with a moral inventory as well, like really looking deeply, which I thought was, it's challenging.
Yes, absolutely. And on that list also, you look at all your relationships from your childhood, and I was asked to even dig out my old high school photos and think and try to find lists of friends from when you were young and think through every single person. I was looking at the person and thinking, did I say something to this person? Was I part of bullying this person as a child? You know, and then it was really doing that detailed audit on everything. And you might have said something to your neighbor. In my case, there was, I could remember one incident with my sister a few years earlier. I wrote down that on the list, and it's really taking stock properly. Yeah.
That's courage. That's courage walking now, Nick, to do that, I think. That's very impressive. Yeah.
Yeah. And once you've done that, you can move forward to the next step. And that is really then, it's best to be discussing this with a coach or a sponsor or a colleague or a friend. And then think for each single line, if you were to get help with this, who would you ask? Or what would be the action you can do there? And then it's just going over that list. We don't have to take action yet. We just write down that and prepare ourselves for later on basically asking for help. And in my case, it was to go see a doctor for my alcohol addiction, my overweight, getting into a recovery program and so on. It was just getting ready there to ask for people. I asked the coach to help me with the wearable devices, setting up a training plan and so on.
And also you've reading the books as part of that, getting yourself the help, isn't it? It's asking the experts in another way, as well as asking physically the experts, which I thought was really cool. Yeah,
absolutely. And then coming into then the third step, I said that before we can do much else, we have to get healthy. And with that, I mean physical, mental and emotional health. And that was what I did. I really focused on that first. I spent 3 months, as I said, to taper off my medication, to really focus on the diet and exercise, to get in a really, really, really good space. So I felt proud of myself. And it's also an easy win. We all know that once we put on some weight and to lose that off, we start to get some confidence, and that can then spread over to other areas of our lives.
Yeah. And I love that you have sleep in there as a priority, because I think globally people are undersleeping anyway. You need sleep. You need enough of it, and you need to make sure that you manage that you get it in order to function better.
It's interesting you mentioned that, Patricia. If you ask me, one thing was the most important these days, once I now have I'm eating a healthy diet and exercise, it's definitely sleep. And also with the wearable devices, I'm tracking that. I can see the quality of my sleep, how long I sleep, and I plan for sleeping. I make sure I focus on that and that I allocate the time needed for it. And everything from these days, it's a little bit noisy where I sleep. So I sleep with earplugs and I can see I get a better sleep, you know, all these kind of things, and make a big difference to your health. Yeah.
Yeah, they do. Sleep, especially all of them, the nutrition, but sleep is the one we ignore. Mm-hmm. And it's so important. That's the, yeah.
Yeah. And then let's move on to step four. So now we have actually, we've done the audit, we started to ask for help, we have sorted ourselves out physically and mentally and emotionally, we're eating well, we're sleeping better. Then we are ready to start fixing relationships. And that means going back to our childhood, if needed, to look up those people and make amends. It could be that some of them we should not go back to if there's a risk that we could harm them or hurt them. Then we just maybe do a prayer on that, or we sign a letter, we write a letter to that person, and then we burn that letter or throw it away. At least we've done the thinking over it in our mind. That's so important. And in my case, I had went back to my sister and I made amends for an incident when I stormed off the lunch table at one family gathering a few years earlier, when I was overwhelmed with emotions and I couldn't deal with it because I was sick. And I explained to her, and of course she forgave me for it, and she said she could hardly remember the incident, so it didn't mean much to her, but I have been walking around with that as my baggage for years.
Wow.
And then I went back to other people from my high school, something I said to someone when I was 13, 14. I met up with them over coffee and they had no idea what I was talking about. But again, this was something that I carried with me. It was some kind of pain. And I also went back then to a credit card company where I had a credit card debt, and I I asked if they could do an installment plan for me because I was behind during this stage. And of course they did that. And I paid that off and I even got a Christmas card from them the following year, you know? So it's about repairing that. Yeah. It's about going back and fixing that, because it's things we carry around that drag us down otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm tingling as you're talking about that, the going back and sitting down and saying, and like that, if it's not as big to the other person, that it was a pain that we carried. I can really, that's huge, I think. I love it. And it liberates you, isn't it? It's freeing. That's the piece. It's really freeing. I love that.
Yeah. I can also mention, when I explained this to my parents who read the book, they had not spoken to their neighbor for about 20 years. So what's about something, the way they cut the grass, or there was something that happened, some incident, you know, and you would just say something and then you don't talk to your neighbor for 20 years. And I said, well, it's not about what they did to you. It's about what you did. It's about cleaning up your side of the street and making amends and apologize for your behavior. Whatever they did is none of your business, because it is your behavior that we need to have clear so that we can move forward without resentments and without pain.
Yeah, I was listening to a podcast only last week or something, and they were talking about apologizing and how do you apologize properly, and how do you ask for an apology, and how does all of that work? But they were talking about it's really important to apologize for your proportion of whatever went wrong in the relationship. So even if you feel like you, not that it's as simple as this, but 90% of the argument that you had was that person and only 10% was yours, that you should still apologize for the 10% that was your fault and that you did wrong. And it was interesting, because there was a conversation then about, and what about if they don't apologize then for the 90%? And it's kind of, you can't control that. You know, you've apologized for the part that you had to play, and you've tried to make amends for that. And I think that also ties in with what you're talking about here, because oftentimes, I suppose, if something negative happened in a relationship that we had with someone, it's very rarely, you know, 100%, or that you would at least look at it that way, that it was 100% my fault, for example. But even if that is the situation, that you weren't fully responsible, I think that's still something that's very important for what you're talking about, of the taking stock and then actionizing what you need to do to clear that off.
Absolutely. And I've gone back to make amends to the companies that I resigned from, where I was let go from, and in fact it was one of them I hanged on to for 5 years because I wasn't sure how to position it, and it's only a month ago that I went back to make amends for this, because it really sat so deeply in me. And I felt that, you know, I was mistreated in the company. I felt I didn't get the paycheck on time. And I felt, why should I go back and make amends? Well, I was talking to my sponsor in the program now, and he said, well, you should look at it on your side of the street. Maybe if your performance would have been better, the company would have had better finances, and maybe you would have had your salary on time. There might be these kind of reasons. So you should still go back and make amends, because your behavior was not always the best, which is true. And it was things that I did that was not great in this job. I sent an email just a few weeks ago then to my ex-boss and apologized for my performance during that time. And also said I was having some alcohol problems and going through some mental health issues during that time. And I'm sorry if I didn't show up at my best. I'm now on a journey of doing better about myself. And I just wanted to say that I'm sorry. And if you're welcome to meet up for a coffee or a Zoom meeting, I'm here. And I then made a prayer on that, and I told my sponsor that now it's sent. And now he said, well, now it's outside of your control. Now, how do you feel? And indeed, I already felt better. Mm. But I couldn't believe the email I received as a reply the next day. He was so happy to hear from me. And he said, oh, I thought something was going through in your life. I couldn't understand what was well. I always see the best in everyone. And I wish you would have told me that you were going through some difficulties at your home front. And then he said, yeah, I'll be happy to meet up. And the next sentence shocked me. He said, I don't have a job for you right now, but maybe we can collaborate on something. So he almost almost offering me a job back, you know, which was not my intention. So it was a complete turnaround. And now that relationship is repaired, and I'm no longer walking around with that on my shoulders. So even it took me 5 years to send that email.
I love that. I absolutely, I love that.
Yeah, it's, you know, and I had an experience recently where somebody who had been really harsh with me, really, really harsh now, and I was hurt and heartbroken and missed them. And they were gone for, they're gone for almost a year out of my life, you know, in a variety of different ways. And they wrote just out of the blue, they wrote something similar and said, you know, I'm sorry, and I was in a difficult place, and I understand that I acted from that place, but I miss you, and I hope everything's okay. And if you can forgive me and have coffee, I immediately wrote back and said I would love to, and I just really admired their courage. I loved that, you know, they sort of went so up in my estimation again for just taking the time that they had carried that, because I had carried it too. So I love this. I love what you're saying.
Yeah, because it's not an easy thing.
No, it's definitely not.
No, but now I have to dig deeper, and I'm sure I have some more that will come up. But I'm trying to do this on a daily basis now. Yeah. As I said, this is really key. Once we clean the past, we are ready to live by these standards. And that's what I'm talking about in my book, how we can do that as well. Mm. And I think that is a nice tie into the fifth step then, because it's about finding your purpose. Yeah. And I know this is sort of a trend. Everyone say finding your purpose and so on, but I think it's meaningless unless you have done the other steps first. If you're again elbowing your way to the top through the rat race, then you might not have cleaned up your past. So how can you even find the right purpose for you? You are walking around with too much weight on your shoulders. There's too many broken things for you to even think about that. You might not be physically, mentally, and emotionally healthy to be ready for it. But once we have done the first steps, then it's really the last step. And that is also how it is in a 12-step program. That what we mean with that is about deflating your ego, seeing that and believing that you're part of something bigger, that you are not the center of the universe, and it's about being of service to other people rather than serving yourself. And that's what it's about here. About, and then I believe we can look for something greater as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love this because it really resonates with how we talk about leadership for the work that we do. And it's very much about being human-centered and really genuine in how you are with yourself and with others. And once you have that in place, life becomes so much better. And it's not always easier, but it certainly is better. So there's just a sense of being really comfortable and being authentic with yourself, or congruent with yourself and with your values. I just love it. I think it's really important. Yeah.
Yeah. Because it comes back to that rigorous honesty piece as well, doesn't it? Because that was something as well that I was very struck by, Nick, when I was reading your book. There's a big jump from obviously where you were to now the place that you are at. And I suppose all of the steps that you would have done in that meantime, there's a lot to it. But if there's someone listening that's feeling like they're resonating with some of the things that you're saying, they're feeling that they may be in a similar position for one reason or another. There was also an element of what you said about the honesty piece. If you open up to one person that you trust, it can become so much easier then to do all of the other things. And I know you, in your story, when you were describing it earlier, you said that when you first said it to your wife, that she then brought you to the doctor, made the appointment, came with you, that type of thing. So while all of these steps obviously would sound like a lot, if you're going through this and you're living it right now, there's an element of just taking that one step, isn't there? And that's what I picked up from reading your book anyway, Nick.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's probably the one key thing that I want to leave with the listeners is just this, what you're mentioning now. It's about if you have something on your mind, perhaps it can sound overwhelming to go through all those steps, but all at least you can do is get a pen and paper and write down the feeling and that whatever the issue is that you're going through, and just think about who can I now have a conversation with about this. Is it a friend? Is it a coach or a mentor that you can have? If not, you go into online and go to a search engine and search. The whole world is full of volunteers, support programs where you can get help. There's hotlines you can call 24/7 and talk to people about the issue. And it doesn't matter if it's alcohol, gambling, sex, or whatever the problem is that you have. There will be people who've gone through it before. You are not that special. You're not that alone in this. We're all here together. And I think that's important to mention.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, I love that. So, Nick, we also like to ask people a few questions as we end up. And one of them might be a leader who inspires you.
and why you would choose them. Could we ask you that?
Yes, absolutely. And his name is Rich Roll, and that's R-I-C-H-R-O-L-L. Okay. He's an American athlete, and he was one of the best Olympic swimmers, or professional swimmer. He one day fell down the stairs and injured himself, and that destroyed his whole professional career as an athlete. He then became one of US best paid top lawyers, but he was not happy with himself. He drank alcohol and was not happy, so he followed a similar path like me. He stopped alcohol, and then eventually also he questioned diets, and he became a vegan. And today he has a blog in the US, which is very much about what we're talking about today. And I'm fully inspired by him and looking. So if anyone wants to look at the blog or listen to his podcast, it's a Rich Roll.
Yeah,
definitely
will.
Definitely
yeah.
Go do it. Yeah, thank you. That's brilliant. Yeah.
The next one, Nick, is looking back on your own journey. Is there anything that you would do differently along the way, knowing what you know now?
Absolutely. I would have loved to have the bravery to ask for help much earlier. And we shouldn't have to hit rock bottom and nearly die, you know, and have so much pain just to protect the life I had. And I just wish I could turn back time and do it earlier.
Well, we're really glad you've done it now and written the book that you've written, and are helping people so much with the way that you're talking, and you're freeing us up a lot to talk about things that we are shy or we push down. So I'm glad you've done it now. I'm sorry you've gone through the tough time, but I'm really glad that what you're making of it. So that's really fantastic for us all. Any advice to someone starting out? What would you advise people who are going to move into
leadership? Yeah, it's really big. It's really, really baby steps, and just trying to be a little bit more honest to yourself, and yeah, taking it slow down, and write down feelings and problems you have, and talk to someone about them. People will care and people will support. And if they don't, then just ask the next person.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I think that's really good advice. And I definitely think slowing down, I was talking about it last week. We need to have that conversation more. The world is speeding up. We need to slow down and see each other, which is very much what you're saying. Is what you're saying is about really seeing each other and being present with each other, and you can't do that at speed. You kind of have mm-hmm. to be slower and more present, which I love.
Absolutely.
Nick, it's been an utter pleasure to, and I said it to you when we met before, that the one thing I feel from you is that what you write and who you are and what you say is all authentic and congruent. It's the same when you meet you as when you read your work, and I love that in someone. So it's been an utter pleasure to talk to you.
Fantastic. Thank you both for having me on the show.
And if we can ever persuade you to visit Ireland, let us know.
Yeah. Yes, I must.
Yeah, no, you'd love it here. It's lovely and green. So great, Nick. Thank you so much. Yeah. We'll put details in relation to the book and to your LinkedIn, if it's okay with you, in the show notes, which we'd like, because I've seen your LinkedIn. There's also some really good suggestions and good ideas and good work happening there too. So if it's okay with you, we'll put all of those in the show notes.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, and we look forward to hopefully staying in touch as well, Nick. It's powerful conversations, and I think the more that we can have them, the better for everyone. Yeah, so yeah. Thank you so much for sharing.
Absolutely. Likewise. Thank you.